this is Tracy Lee Watson, welcoming you to the Laughing Mother Project Podcast Season 2. Here we laugh at the days to come. Hi, ladies. Today we've got a special podcast for you. It's a follow-on from one that we did with Debbie Winfield in Season 1. Debbie spoke about she basically just gave a testimony of giving birth and her birth story to her second son. And it was such a lovely story. You don't need to have listened to that, but I would love you to go back and listen to how she just felt promptings from the Holy Spirit. And the story is so amazing, and this little boy is just a walking miracle. And I think that what I've learned from listening to her is that sometimes we forget to celebrate. There's victories for all of us, and sometimes we can get so busy with looking at what still needs to be done that we don't take the time to celebrate the victories. So this is not a conversation, this is a testimony, and I hope you are so blessed by Debbie's testimony. God bless.
Hi, Trace. Thanks for your message today. It was very encouraging to hear that somebody was encouraged by my part one story. And today's a special day because William took his first couple of steps, and that's big. That's huge in terms of the journey that we've been on with him. And so I'll end with that. But today's a special day because this is the day that we've been working towards, praying for. And really, it's a huge, huge win. So the story continues that I woke up after a couple of days of being heavily sedated and drugged to recover from HELLP syndrome. And we continued to stay in the hospital for a week. William was actually discharged after 3 days, as in the pediatrician checked him over and said he was fine, but I wasn't fine. So whilst he was okay to go, I wasn't okay to go. I was still very poorly with high blood pressure. And it was incredibly stressful because every day they would take my blood pressure at different times of the day. And it needed to be consistent for like 3 or 4 times in a row for you to be discharged. And I would probably do fine on like the second and the third one. And I knew the fourth blood pressure test was the one that would tell me whether I could go home or not, and I would get very stressed, and so of course my blood pressure would spike, and so the cycle continued. And I was desperate at this point to get home. I hadn't seen my eldest son Oliver for almost a month. I had been living in a hospital that's not a private hospital, but by no means a bad hospital. It's the NHS, which is fantastic. But yes, it's not private hospital, so I couldn't eat the food any longer. And my body just wasn't getting what it needed to recover. And after about a week of this going on, I actually opted to self-discharge myself, which I don't recommend anybody does. But I really felt very strongly that I wasn't going to get better if I continued in this place of being stuck in a room, and not having home comforts, home food, and just getting myself pretty worked up and exhausted. I also knew my mom and dad were arriving in the next couple of days after this point. They were well on their way at this time. Their visa had come through. And so I knew I could go home. I could relax. I could have people to take care of me. Not just people, the best people in the world. There's nothing like your mom and dad, no matter what age you are, to come and rescue you from any situation. And I just knew that was the right thing to do. And it was, because a couple of days after I left, there were strong recommendations of that I had to take my own blood pressure. I was discharged with very heavy medication and actually having to inject myself every day in my thigh was part of that for 6 weeks after the birth. So it wasn't easy, but yes, I mean, 3 days after I got home with William, my mom and dad arrived, and that was a great turning point for me, that I could just sleep for a good few hours in the day catch up. William was sleeping anyway, so I could sleep between his feeds. And it was just a huge, huge relief. But I had this overwhelming feeling that something still wasn't right. And I had to fight really hard with myself. Was this a negative voice, or was this the still voice of a mom's intuition? And I would speak to my mom about it, which was fantastic. To be able to talk to my mom was the best thing. And she used to say to me, "I'm sure he's fine, but you need to raise your concerns at your 6-week checkup. Whatever you're feeling, you can talk to the doctor that does your 6-week discharge and William's 6-week checkup." But she said, "Don't harp on that. You're fine. He's fine. He's perfect. Just rest." But I kept saying to her, "Mom, I don't know if he's okay. I just don't think he's okay. There's something that's not right." And to be honest, I did just think, look, part of it was, how miraculous is this situation that he survived this ordeal that could have turned out very differently, that he was premature and as dinky and tiny as they come, but he didn't need to go into the neonatal intensive care unit. He breathed on his own. He fought off jaundice. He was eating fine, drinking fine. I couldn't breastfeed because my milk just didn't come in, which was a huge disappointment, but I had to pick my battles and I had to just really have my cry about that and let it go, because I knew the most important thing was that he was getting a lot of food, probably more regularly than what a normal newborn baby would need because he was premature. And I knew that my milk had not come in because I had been so sick, and they had told me that that was probably going to happen, so they had prepared me. But still, it was, I had to have a cry over that. But I moved over that, and I just knew he was eating well. He had a bit of reflux, which was because he was premature. I had health visitor coming in, checking in more regularly than a baby that was born entirely healthy. So the health visitor would come weekly, and she explained that, yes, he was going to have reflux because maybe his certain parts of that help him drink and keep the milk down weren't fully developed. And so she gave us hints and tips of how to keep him upright, etc. Just normal things you would expect with a newborn baby. But still, there was something that just said to me, this is not the end. Prepare yourself. Something is not right. And at the 6-week checkup, which is normally a full checkup for me and a full checkup for William, and you officially discharge at that point here in the UK, and then you just attend the weigh-in clinics, etc. After that point, I had been feeling a ridge on William's head that was unfamiliar to me. All I had to compare it to was Oliver, who didn't have that ridge. I also felt that William didn't have a soft spot. So you can it's very distinct on a baby, that soft spot that's on their head. And he didn't have a soft spot, and he had a ridge on his head. And I kept feeling it, and I kept saying to my family, why has he got this ridge on his head? That's not normal. And I can't feel a soft spot. And the pediatrician in the hospital had said to us about the soft spot that actually premature babies sometimes take a while for their soft spot to develop, and it was nothing to really be concerned about. So that didn't concern me as much as that ridge on his head concerned me. So the first thing I said to the doctor at the 6-week checkup is, I'm really concerned about William's head. He's got this ridge and he doesn't have a soft spot. Please, could you thoroughly examine his head? Not expecting what came after that. I have to say, even this continuous burning feeling that I had, which was this voice that I look back now was the Lord telling me, prepare yourself, this is not over. And yes, there's something not right that will need to be fixed. I didn't quite prepare myself for what was to come, But the doctor felt his head, and her immediate reaction told me this was not normal. This is something that's very rare and possibly something she's never actually encountered herself in her career, but she knew about it. And she said to me, yes, you're right, there isn't a soft spot and that ridge is not normal. And it was the first time that I had heard of this condition, because she then said the word craniosynostosis, which has taken me a long time to even learn how to pronounce. At first, and for probably the first year of William's life, I was saying craniosynostosis. It's not, it's craniosynostosis. I can't even say it. It's a mouthful. And I was like, you know, sorry, what is that? And she explained that there's different forms of it, but sometimes it's very, very rare. I don't know what it is, like 1 in 10,000 babies or something like that can be born where their skull fuses too early. Babies are born with an open skull, allowing their brain the time to grow. And by the time they're an adult, that's completely fused. So as they develop and the brain gets bigger, so the skull bones fuse, but that happens over time, over some years. And William's was already fused. She suspected it was already fused, which meant that his brain essentially wouldn't have the space to grow, and that can cause a lot of major complications and can actually be life-threatening. And this is where I look back and I take every bit of what happened that day with gratitude, because the way she handled that situation was just brilliant. She told my mum and I to wait outside the waiting room. She said, I'm going to make a phone call now. Normally I would do a referral. You'd have to wait some weeks to get your letter through the post to get a referral to see a pediatrician. That's the first step. She said, but I'm going to make a call and I want you to wait outside the room, because it's I'm going to make it sound probably a lot worse than it is, because I want you to be seen today so you can have some peace of mind. So we waited outside the room and it was silence, and William was calm and my mom was very calm, because she's the most calm woman I have ever met, and there could not have been a better person to be by my side that day. So she was my angel that day. And she called us back into the room and she said, I've made some calls. You've got an appointment straight away at High Wycombe Children's Pediatric Department. Go there now, which is about a half an hour drive away, and somebody will see you. So we went, and there was still a calmness about everything that was happening. I think I went into very practical mode, which was my coping mechanism, which was one of, okay, I can do this. I'm going to understand this. Let's be practical and know the facts. And until I know the facts, I'm not going to panic. And so we went, and we were seen fairly quickly, and a pediatrician looked William over and said, look, 90%, that is the diagnosis. He has some form of craniosynostosis. There are different forms of it, and it depends on which bones have fused, and it depends on how many have fused. And he will need to be seen by a specialist children hospital. And so the pediatrician said he was going to do a referral straight away. And he gave us the option of which hospitals. There's only 4 hospitals in the whole of the UK that deal with this condition. And he said to us, look, the closest one for you is Oxford Children's Hospital. And I said, yes, that's perfect. We can drive there. That's great. It's an hour away. That's no problem. And I came home I had been on the phone to Andrew, William's dad, to updating him throughout the day. But it sunk in when we got home, and when Andrew got home from work and my mom and dad were there and we were talking about it. And as you start to research this condition, because it's only natural and only human nature, and for me, again, my coping mechanism is to arm myself with as many facts as I can possibly have. I want to know all the facts. Whereas Andrew, William's dad, is completely the opposite. He didn't want to know the facts. That's how he coped with it. He didn't want to know anything. He just didn't want to know. But there was such a sadness and a grieving, between us as a couple and for William and as a family, because it was the shock of we've just come through such a big thing and now we're going to embark on this journey that is feels right now like it is a mountain we can't climb. We are exhausted at this point as it stands. We are only just recovering, and yet now we are trying to figure this all out. And the weeks that followed that is a waiting game, because essentially you're waiting for the letter to come through the post for the specialist appointment. And so you've got this time that you can only do your own research on the condition, and you don't know which part of this he's got. You don't know whether it's, there's different ones, sagittal, metopic. You don't know which one he's got. And so the outcome is different depending on which type of craniosynostosis a baby has. And it was really hard to switch off and not to get the facts, but I was determined that I was going to get the facts, I was going to know the facts, and I was going to hear worst case scenario, best case scenario, that I'd be armed before that first appointment. And I went through a couple of weeks of allowing myself to grieve, but I also knew that I couldn't grieve and stay in that state for long, that I had to allow myself that heartbreaking, sobbing feeling and crying out to the Lord and looking at my little baby and putting my hands on his head and praying for his head and sobbing. I had to allow myself that process. I just knew that that for me was the right thing to do. But I also knew that there had to come a point that I had to become stronger and I had to face the next phase of this situation. And we were very, very blessed because there was a cancellation and we actually got a letter through the post much quicker than they said. They estimated we would have to wait 3 months for that appointment, and it was a month. And my mom and dad had just flown back to South Africa, and we set off for this appointment in Oxford. And I'll never forget that first day walking into a children's hospital, into a specialist unit. It was the craniosynostosis facial plastic surgeon unit. And you are sitting there in a waiting room and you are seeing things that you've not seen before or didn't even know existed, conditions and families that are going through tremendous, tremendous heartache and pain with their little ones. And I had never been in this situation before. And you're waiting for this first appointment and you're seeing all of this, and you know, you go in and you're surrounded by, must have been at least 10 medical professionals, because the way that they do it, they do a kind of like a whole team so that you don't have to go to all these different appointments. It's pretty overwhelming, and they do give you a call beforehand to let you know that this is how it's going to be. So you have psychologist, a family psychologist to support you through it. You have a neurosurgeon, you have a plastic surgeon, you have an eye doctor, you have a ear, nose and throat specialist, you have a speech therapist. And the list just goes on of these medical professionals that are allocated to you as your team that are going to see you through this journey, which is overwhelming but phenomenal in the same time, that you're sitting there as this couple with this baby and you've got these people all teaming together to listen to you and to help you. And that was pretty amazing to me. And they confirmed that yes, 99%, it's probably likely he has the most common form of craniosynostosis, which is sagittal. So the back skull bone is fused, which would normally cause almost like a boat-shaped head, so an elongated head with a bulging forehead over time. And that the outcome would be that before he was two, he would need a reconstructive surgery, but that every child is different and that they would monitor him closely. And every 3 months, he would be monitored and they would make a decision. And I just really felt that I needed to make a decision that I wasn't going to let this overshadow William's first year. I was on maternity leave for 9 months of that, and I wanted to embrace and enjoy. I knew he'd be my last baby. And there's something about that for any and every mom, whether you have one and you know it's your last, whether you have two and you know it's your last, three, four, five, if it's your last baby, you know it's your last baby. And you hang on to every moment with every baby, but I think your last baby, you just know, like, I'm really going to just hang on to this, especially with a big age gap. I felt very blessed to have this little one so much later on. And I didn't want to spend his first year feeling sad. I didn't want to spend his first year looking at everything he did, thinking, that's delayed, that's late, why are you doing that? But just with stress and worry and anxiety. So I made a decision that day that I was going to take what the specialist told me and I was going to forget about everything else. If it was good news, it was good news. And that was that until the next appointment, until I knew otherwise, until they said to me, it's not good news, this is what needs to happen, I was going to take it as it was. We went back when he was 3 months and had a CT scan. And normally they have to give a baby anesthetic because they have to be very still. And I prayed that this wouldn't happen. And literally 5 minutes before the scan, I managed to get William to fall asleep in my arms, placed him on the CT scan bed and just stood with him for as long as I could, gave him all the things that I knew comforted him until he had the scan and he slept through the whole thing. And it's little things like that, that I had everybody that I knew praying and I was praying and I had peace. It was just little steps and little things like that that just meant so much to me. And it was confirmed probably shortly after that from the result that, yes, he had sagittal craniosynostosis. And, yes, that they were just going to monitor him every 3 months and see when, if, how he would need an operation. But 90% of the time, it is needs an operation, this condition, before the child is maybe two or three. And I don't know how, but I did carry on and just enjoyed life. There were moments that I had a wobble or I felt sad or had one or two down days of worry and anxiety. Particularly because William was very delayed from his physical development. So he wasn't sitting. He wasn't, he was very late to even smile. He was very late to just do a lot of things that milestone-wise babies would do. And even sitting, I think it was only around nine months that he was sitting. So that was a little bit of a challenge, just trying to not let that overshadow things, because I kept saying to myself, his development delay is because he's got this condition. And then, the medical professionals would say, well, it could be, but it also could not be, because some babies at this stage are not sitting or not crawling or whatever the case is. But we got to a year old and he still wasn't crawling. He was sitting, and the bulging of his forehead was becoming a lot more prominent. And it was hard to ignore, but every appointment that we had, they were telling us that actually, and to be honest, the research I had done, he wasn't presenting the shape of the head that a baby with this condition would normally have. His was very mild. But the other side of that was that because his head wasn't trying to protrude out in strange ways, the risk of having pressure on his brain was higher. And so it was a very fine balance. And I remember when he was probably 13 months maybe. He wasn't sleeping well. He was becoming miserable. His mood was changing. He was normally quite a placid, happy baby. And he was vomiting unexpectedly, normally in the evening. So sometimes we would go in his cot and he had got sick. Or just before bed, he had got sick. And again, I just felt like something wasn't right. So we went for an out of routine appointment, which was like one in between the 3 monthly checkup. And they checked him over and said, he's fine. He's absolutely fine. And we expressed our concerns about the development delays, that he wasn't moving at all. He was just sitting. And again, we were told, look, you know, that can be nothing at all. It can just be a late developer. And that he was fine. But I just still felt something wasn't right. And when we went back a couple of months later for his routine appointment, they said, well, at this appointment, we do an eye test. It's routine, but we really look at the back of the eyes and we test for pressure. Normally at about sort of 15, 16 months is a good time, because almost 99.9% of babies at this age with this condition haven't developed pressure yet. But around about now, we feel it's the right time to start measuring if there's any pressure on the brain. And so we proceeded to the eye test. And again, it was one of those moments where the person doing the eye test was taken aback, but was trying to hide it really well. But I could see on the screen that there was a lot of zigzag movements at the back of his eyes. And I knew, I'm not a medical professional, but you know, it should be a round, smooth circle almost. And he said, I need a second opinion. And that day we actually had William's granny with us, Andrew's mother. And again, a huge blessing. She had actually just been very keen to come with. She's a nurse herself. And she was just very, very keen to come with to one of the appointments and see. So she had taken a day off and come with us. And so we had gone into like a state of, you know, I guess, shock and panic again as to, okay, this confirms that yes, this poor child of ours has got a problem. He has got pressure on the brain, and you just, the whole day just unraveled. We were there the whole entire day at the hospital, having tests, having more senior doctors look at him, check him over, call back into the room of all these team of specialists at the end of the day to tell us that this is rare. In fact, they've hardly ever seen it at almost 16 months, but William has quite significant pressure on his brain already. And it's now an emergency, because at this point, they don't know how long that's been there. They don't know quite the severity of it, but they know that it can cause brain damage, it can cause stroke, and it can cause death. And that can happen in a day. It can happen the next day. It can happen in a week's time. They don't know, but they know that this is now an emergency. And so we were booked in for the following week, but William was at nursery and he was going through that stage that all children go through. They get coughs and colds and sniffles and teething and whatnot. So we went for the following week for the emergency operation, prepared ourselves, arrived on the Sunday, stayed overnight in a lovely children's charity in the hospital that's called Ronald McDonald House, which is like a accommodation for parents who have very ill children that can actually stay in the hospital and have a room and a bathroom and a kitchen that you can use while you're staying in hospital with your child, which again is a huge blessing. And so we arrived on the Sunday night to be down at the ward at 8 o'clock the next day, all prepared, but we knew William wasn't quite right, a mild temperature, green snotty nose. And the anaesthetist took one check and said, not a chance, not a chance. We cannot do a 7-hour operation. He has to be in 100% health. This is major operation and it affects all his breathing, everything. It's too much of a risk. And so they sent us home. And we had to keep William off nursery because going back and mixing with other children and picking up germs was the thing that we needed to avoid because it was now an emergency, and they told us we need to get him into a place of good health so that he could have this operation as soon as possible. So I'm just all along the way counting the blessings. Work was fantastic. Both of our work was absolutely fantastic. Work from home, don't worry. Do what you need to do. Take the time you need to take. Absolutely supportive. And in these situations, it's those type of things that just make the difference. And they make you wait 10 full days after the medical team say he's not fit for the operation because they need the virus to be completely out of his system. And so that was rescheduled 10 days afterwards, but actually it ended up being 2 weeks after. And so we went back to the hospital on a Sunday night, back to get ready for the operation. And actually, this was the week that the whole country was going into lockdown because of COVID. And that was the strangest day, but we had, you go down to the ward and there's all these families there waiting for their children to have their operations, and you get fully assessed, fully checked. The anesthetist comes and talks to you. You get given a time that your child is going to go to theatre and fully monitored and checked over. And that's the process in the morning. And so we were sitting in a room full of families, and something wasn't right because the time was ticking on. William couldn't eat since 2 a.m. the morning before, and so it's now 11 o'clock. He still hasn't been able to eat, and that took a lot of prayer just to keep him calm and just to help him sleep and just to rest. I know he was hungry. We were anxious, but not to let him feel that anxiousness. And we got called at about 11:30, 12 maybe, into a side room to say, look, the hospital's gone into lockdown. Unless it's an emergency, no operation is taking place today. And it was like within half an hour, that room was empty, except for two families. We were one of those two families. And we were told that the medical teams needed to go step aside and decide and debate which family needed the operation more than the other one. They could only do one operation that day because of the COVID situation. And so we were on the brink of being sent home again with a child with pressure on his brain, not knowing when next, because of COVID, we would be able to get this operation done. And throughout this time, I'm texting my mom and dad, I'm texting Andrew's parents, and we're praying and praying and praying and praying and praying that, Lord, just have your will be done, your way be done in your time. And my dad kept saying, God's got this in his time. You don't know why, you don't know how this has happened and why it's happened this way, but it's in his time. And rest in that peace that it's in God's time and it's in God's hands. And I really did take that to heart. And the surgeons came back and they said they've decided William is the child who's going to have the operation that day. And it was really hard to see the other family. We both knew the situation we were in, to see them having to go. And they were very gracious about it. And it happened pretty quickly after that. I think by 1 o'clock, William had gone into theatre. And it was a 7-hour operation. And they don't check in, you don't hear a thing. And I went down to the theatre with William and I went through the whole anaesthetic with him at the point where he was under anaesthetic and they asked me to leave the room. And I did that because his dad just was inconsolable. And I felt like I was riding on this absolute peace, a godlike peace I've never experienced before. It was something else. I was just at complete peace. And William could feel that. So he was entertaining everybody on the way to the theater, right to the point that he fell asleep. He was calm. And everybody in that theater looked at me and said, we've never had a baby or a mom be this peaceful and this calm. That was amazing. And these are just the things that I remember and the things that I hang on to as God's presence and his promise and his peace. And we took advice to go away from the hospital, to go for a walk, to go shopping, to do something, even to go to the cinema, to distract ourselves. It's a long wait. And so we went to the cinema and we went shopping. And people say, how could you do that? How did you manage to do that? And actually, it was the best thing we could have done. We had something to eat. We went out and we came back to the hospital at 7 o'clock, and we got a call probably about 7:30 in the evening from the main surgeon, the plastic surgeon, to say everything went textbook perfectly and he would meet us down in the ward in 10 minutes to come and tell us everything. And he came and he sat next to us and he said that operation had to have happened today. When they took William's skull off, they could see his brain expand because it had been so squashed from the pressure. They could visibly see that brain expand. And he said it was absolutely critical. They didn't know, and you can hardly ever tell until you open up the skull and you remove the skull, the level of pressure. But he said it was textbook operation. We would get a call from the intensive care unit in the next 30 minutes and we could go down and see William. And so it was just one answer to prayer after the next. And we went down and saw William, and the loveliest nurses were looking after him. And he was pretty much out of it and full of, you know, pipes and machines and drains and you name it, but they'd prepared us for that. They had really prepared us for that. They told us exactly what he was going to look like, exactly what he was going to have in his body and how it was going to be. And so we were ready, mentally ready for that. And there are things that happened because of COVID. The hospital was pretty deserted and the intensive care unit was pretty deserted, which meant William had a lot of dedicated, highly skilled professional care in the intensive care unit. And my superpower is certainly not being tired. I can tell you I don't function well if I'm tired. I need my sleep. And Andrew is very good at sleeping anywhere. And so we had decided amongst ourselves that he would take the night duty. I would leave at about 10:30, 11 and go and get some sleep up in the room at this Ronald McDonald charity house within the hospital, and that he would sleep on the bed next to William. And I would come back down at 8 o'clock in the morning, take over, and he would go up, have a shower, go to sleep until whenever he woke up, 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock in the afternoon. We would have a shift where we did it together, and then I would go. And I think that's so important when you have a child who is critically ill or going through something that's a huge operation, agreeing what your strengths are with your husband or your partner or your parents or whoever's going to support you, agreeing that beforehand was advice that we were given and advice we took, and it was absolutely life-saving because we were both exhausted, we were emotionally drained, but we knew the routine and we knew what we had agreed and we stuck to that. There was very little conversation, we were just getting by. But we knew what we needed to do to make those days work. And William had coughed a little bit because he had been in the operation for so long, lying face down. There'd been fluid that had developed in his lungs. And because he coughed, and this was a new thing for the whole hospital with this whole COVID situation, immediately they were on high alert. And we were told he needs to have a COVID test and he needs to be isolated. So he needs to move into an isolated high intensive care unit until the results of his COVID test came back. And of course, as any parent, you think, well, your child's just gone through this. Now they're telling you he has to have a COVID test. And your first reaction is going to be, really? Are you being serious? What now? What next? But I knew he didn't have COVID. And I knew this was just a heightened reaction. But what it gave us was a whole entire intensive care unit with just William in, and it was probably, it could accommodate 12 beds, but it had only William in. He was being isolated, which meant he had a dedicated high intensive care unit doctor and two nurses 24/7 allocated just to him. Because of the way they had to split the wards, they always have a high intensive care pediatrician, doctor, critical care that oversees the whole ward. So it can be 12 patients, and then you've got, you know, a number of nurses, but that was like the minimum that you're allowed to have, even if you've got one patient in a full ward. And normally those tests can come back pretty quickly. And actually Williams took 48 hours. So we had two full days of having this dedicated care. William's waking up, so I'm just going to go and give him his bottle and then I'll carry on.
Don't you just love Jesus? Don't you love how he does it all through scripture, and here is just an example of how he works all things for our good, and that he's making secret ways and passageways and tunnels and opportunities and blessing and favor and things that like just can't be explained by human explanations. It's just the grace of God. How good is God? How much does he love us? What good care does he take of us?
So, yeah, so we had the best care, and then William was moved to the main ward and had a bit of an upset stomach from all the antibiotics he was on. And again, they couldn't take any chances, and they needed to send some tests away to make sure it wasn't a stomach bug. And so they gave us a private room. And so for the duration of William's hospital stay for the week, we had one-on-one dedicated medical care staff, and we were in private rooms. And this is just an absolute blessing. I can't tell you, when you're going through something like that, just what a blessing. We felt like we had such care, and we were so looked after in every way. And because of COVID, nobody was allowed in the hospital again. So it was really funny. When I was in hospital, really ill, pregnant with William, same thing. The hospital was in lockdown. This time it was in lockdown for a different reason. And so his grandparents, who had actually taken the week off to come and stay in Oxford to help us, relieve us, let us go and sleep, sit with William for a couple of hours in the afternoons or whatever, couldn't even come into the ward. So it was just us. It was just the three of us, and we had to get through it. My mum and dad had actually got their visa ready to come over as well. For this time, for the operation, and or at least for after the operation, because we wanted to keep William at home for as long as possible without having to go back to nursery. And so they could look after him, and their visa got stopped because of COVID. They weren't allowed to travel. So this is the time that the Lord picked for us, for William, to have this operation. And whilst you can look at all the negatives, there are so many positives. And one word I would say that sums up this whole experience and continues to do so for me is perspective. For me personally, and this is my own truth and my own experience, perspective was powerful, and having the choice as well. And every situation was presented with a choice, and my choice would determine how I would cope with it and what the outcome would essentially be for me. And that's one thing my dad always used to tell me growing up, is that everything's about a choice, and every choice you make could have a negative or a positive outcome, impact, or effect on you. And the choices you make are the most important thing, and the decisions you make are the most important thing. And so I chose to keep looking at the positives and not focusing on what could have very quickly been the negatives, which could have been, it was an emergency. How did we not know you had pressure? Why didn't they tell us? What damage has it done? We're in a lockdown situation. I mean, those thoughts did go through my head, but at the same time, I pushed them away very quickly with trying to see the positive side, which was, we're having dedicated support. We've got the best medical professionals. We have an isolated ward and private rooms. They caught it in time. They acted quickly. He got through it with flying colors. We're on the other side. We can do this. He can do this. He's bouncing back quickly. Look at him. He's so strong. All these positive thoughts was what I chose to focus on. And we got through it. And amazingly, obviously, everything had gone into lockdown here in the UK. So we both went back to work a couple of weeks, or probably even a week after we were out of hospital, to a very, very busy, busy work situation. Both of our companies had the opposite effect of what COVID would have on some companies, in that it was extra busy. And so we were at home with the toddler that we were nursing back to full health, working full time. But again, I chose to say, look, I'm at home now for the next 4 or 5 months. Nursery had closed. He couldn't go back to nursery anyway. And what a blessing to have his parents just around him 24/7, because he came out of hospital a little bit insecure, as you would expect, bad sleeping, didn't want to go back into his cot for 10 days after we got home. He'd only sleep in his pushchair, his buggy. Just all the things that you would expect that a child would have, having going through for them quite a traumatic experience. But we were there, dedicated to him every day. We were in a lockdown situation, so there was no busyness of, other than work, having to go anywhere or get back into London for work or anything. We were just a family at home looking after our baby, giving him that reassurance and that care that he needed to come through the other side. And he bounced back so quickly. It was amazing to see. But when I talk about perspective, I refer back to those days that we would go for those routine appointments, and I would see other parents waiting with their child for their routine appointment, and their situation was a lot more critical. Their child had a lot more severe symptoms and side effects of different conditions. And I'll never forget the one day walking past a mom who had a tiny baby who probably had, and I don't even know all the different types of this condition, but this baby, I think, had the worst case scenario where it caused instant deformities in the face, the breathing, you know, how the baby could breathe and eat and see and hear. And I remember seeing this mom trying to calm her probably a few days old baby who'd been born with all of this going on. And this mom was just waiting and trying for the appointment, trying to calm her tiny baby down. And I actually had to take myself off into the bath, to the toilet, the ladies' toilets, because I was so moved and emotional by what I was seeing. Because I had this moment where my heart broke. I could actually physically feel it breaking. And I just went into the toilet and cried to the Lord and said to him, I don't know what I'm about to walk into myself for this next appointment, but take every ounce of strength that I have and give it to that mom, because she needs it more than I do. I get quite emotional actually thinking about that. I can't even explain it to you. I just knew that I was going to be absolutely fine, and I had to cry to the Lord for the strength for that mom, because her journey was going to be a lot longer and a lot harder. And that baby, that beautiful baby, was going to face many, many, many more challenges than what my little William was going to face. And I just wanted the strength of the Lord to go to that mom on that day and for all the days that followed. And it helps you put things into perspective very, very quickly. And perspective, as I said, is incredibly powerful. And it just makes you realize that actually, you know, you can cope. It will be fine. It's going to be okay. And even whilst we were in hospital, I would use the communal kitchen with other parents that were there for their critically ill children. And I remember striking up a conversation with one of the moms every morning, or when we would bump into each other making a cup of tea. And after seeing each other for a couple of days, you know, she said to me, "Oh, you know, is your little one okay? What's happened?" And I explained, and she was so empathetic and sympathetic and really listened. And I said, "Oh, and what about your little one?" And she said, "Oh, my little girl's 5, and this is the second time we're in hospital for a tumor on her brain. The first time was cancerous, and they removed the tumor when she was 3, and she was in remission and has come back. And so she's just gone into theatre to have a biopsy of the tumor, and they're waiting for the results to see whether the cancer is back." And just like that, there it is, perspective. Because just when you think you're facing whatever it is, the hardest thing, there's always somebody next to you, next door to you, down the road, up the road, in the same hospital, in the bed next to you, whatever the situation is, who's probably facing something that's a lot bigger. And I just counted my blessings right there, right then, that William's condition was fixable, it was curable, it wasn't going to affect his whole life. And whilst he would have some delays, these were things that could all be overcome in time. And it was just, for me, having that perspective and those perspective moments was so powerful. And actually, yes, William has had development delays. He had a full test. His cognitive and speech is absolutely fine, and in some ways even advanced. But his physical development is very delayed. And so when we came out of hospital and after a full development assessment, they allocated us a physiotherapist. And we've been working with this physiotherapist every couple of weeks, having a session, just small, tiny, tiny tasks and actions to set, and exercises for William to get him walking. And it's hard because he's frustrated. He's almost 2 and he can't walk, and he's an active child. And he's been going to nursery, and he's been seeing all his friends walk. And we go to the park and it's muddy. And he doesn't want to be in his buggy, and he doesn't want to be held. He wants to be running around freely like all the other little 2-year-olds around him. And he has to just, he doesn't crawl, he bum shuffles. And so he pulls himself along on his bottom, and he gets muddy within 2 seconds. And it's just all upside down, inside out, as you can imagine. And I've just got to let him go, and I've just got to let him get muddy, because he's frustrated and he wants that freedom. And other parents look at you and like, "Why is your child not walking?" And with grace and patience, I explain. I've explained the story so many times, and that's absolutely fine, and I will keep doing that. But today he stood for a long time on his own, and then he took 2 little steps towards me, and then he collapsed into my lap. And then he did it again. And that is a huge, huge victory and an absolute blessing and a win. And I'm going to take that. And today is a good day. And he's going to walk. And my prayer has been that he'll walk by the time he's 2, which is on the 22nd of November. And throughout this whole process with William, I've broken it down into the next stage, the next milestone, the next thing that I can see that's tangible, that can be measured. Because if I looked too far forward, it could be overwhelming. But I just knew, if I just looked at, okay, when is the next appointment? When is the next test? You know, let me just measure how he's doing up till that point. And I've set myself, since we came out of hospital, I've been praying that by the time he's 2, he will walk. And I've been trusting the Lord for that. And he's not far off too. And today he took some steps, and the delight on his face, he knew he had done this thing. He knew he had conquered this challenge. He understands everything. And that's just my story of this journey of having a child who is diagnosed with a rare condition, and you have to go on this journey. The takeaways are just trusting the Lord, having perspective, setting milestones that you can tangibly work towards without getting yourself worked up and thinking too far ahead. Having those people that you can go to on those days that you do have off days, and allowing yourself to have those days. I've had those days, and I've gone to my mom, sometimes sobbing on the phone because I've allowed myself to overthink something or to get too worried or anxious about something that hasn't even been diagnosed yet or hasn't even been given as the outcome. And don't be hard on yourself. Give yourself those days, but have the people that you can go to, that you can speak to, that you trust and can speak life and give you that strength back that you need. But on the whole, you know, just to be setting those goals and praying into that has been hugely, hugely helpful. And we're not there yet. And we're told we'll never really know the full extent of if there was any damage from the pressure on the brain or for how long that pressure was there until he grows up, until he goes to school, until he starts learning and all these things. But I'm not going to think about that. I'm praying for a future, a full, happy future. I'm trusting for that. And I will cross each bridge as we've done, as it happens. But for now, I'm taking the wins, and I'm taking those wins, and I'm running with those wins, and I'm focusing on the wins. And today was a win. So that's the story of this next phase that we're in with little William. Thanks, Trace. Lots of love.
Doesn't William's story just speak about Psalm 139? It really does to me, that we can never escape God, that he can look and find us. His eyes are never off us. It doesn't matter where we go to, we'll find him there and he'll find us. And also the fact that he created the innermost delicate, intricate parts of us while we were growing in our mother's womb. We followed the first episode of how Debbie felt the promptings of God in her pregnancy and in her birth story. God has so many thoughts about William, and he has so many thoughts about us. We cannot even count them. And I think God is the one who's actually doing the victory lap when we overcome, when he calls us more than overcomers. Jesus is proud of you today. Well done for any small victory that you can claim.